Accession number 27083, reel 62.
My second question goes back to the Bermudagram and John Knott, who was in the United States at that, had just been in the United States at
yes.
that point. What, as I can see it, what he is suggesting for the Royal Navy is a massive change of direction. Did you get from your American counterparts any indication from them of what they thought about this massive change in direction for the Royal Navy? And was there, do you think, any influence cast over at either a government level or through you on the Defence Review from the US end?
Answering the latter part of your question first, none whatsoever. And I don't think that John Knott could have got it. I don't think it existed. I think that this was entirely a matter he'd gone over, you see, very responsibly to meet for the first time his opposite, American opposite number. For precisely the sort of reasons that I went over to meet my opposite
this
number.
This was Caspar Weinberger, was it?
It was.
The American.
It was indeed, yes.
Okay.
And I don't know, I wasn't privy to what was discussed between them, but I have no reason to suppose that John Knott put to Weinberger anything specific. He might have mentioned the fact that we were going through a defense review in general terms, but I don't think he would have discussed specifics, because the specifics had by no means been settled by then, which was why, when he got to Bermuda, that he settled down to sort his own mind out. He having been given the remit by the Prime Minister to get in there and cough up. And he therefore had to formulate ideas which he was then going to pursue, presumably as far as he judged desirable in the circumstances, in order to get the money that was being called for. And that was what he preconceived as being the broad pattern of distribution of the cuts. And we come back to what we discussed briefly earlier on. How he, what caused him to conceive of that distribution, I still don't know. But he was an intelligent man, of course. He had by then received his various briefings. He was not a good listener. He tended, having decided in his own mind that such and such a course of action was the right one and the one to be pursued, he tended to go driving ahead with that, unless you had the most overridingly convincing fundamental reasons with which to oppose it, which was not always the case. And just to say, I don't want to reduce the submarine force, wouldn't get you off the ground at all.
No.
That was the way it went.
Thank you. My third question is this, and again, it really goes back towards the beginning. I'll put it this way, if I may. Did you and your fellow chiefs of staff ever ask what the government's defence requirements subsequent to the implementation of the cuts would be, given that we did decide earlier that they were finance-driven, not, if you like, defence commitment-driven? The government must have said, you must have said, well, look, if you do this, the degree to which we could do X, Y, and Z is going to be substantially limited. Did you have those sorts of discussions with them? And
not in my time, and not with the government. I suppose you could say that I personally came very close to it, and I'll come on to this later, when I exercised my right to make a direct approach to the Prime Minister. But this matter had been raised previously, about the time when I was Vice Chief of Defence, when Michael Carver was Chief of the Defence Staff. And they had gone through, I'm not sure that I've got the nomenclature quite right, but what amounted to the minimum irreducible level. And I haven't got the wording quite as they put it, but I think that conveys the sense. And they'd reached, they'd done a major tri-service exercise on this, and they'd come out with a certain level of capability, which meant that if we went below that level, you would impair the national capability to do what at the time was considered necessary for the proper conduct of national affairs. But by the time I'm talking of now, we'd already gone below that. And so that particular exercise was really a one-off. And having said it was irreducible, and then proceeded to reduce it, you couldn't play that card again because it wouldn't cut in the ice. So, as a generalization, the answer is no. There was not a representation. It appeared in various papers, you can't do that, you shouldn't do the other, and so forth. But this was picking and choosing. It wasn't a general thing. We didn't fall in as a body and said, we won't do this, otherwise we'll all resign, or anything like that. And it wouldn't have made any odds if we'd said we would.
No, perhaps with that particular government it wouldn't have done.
Well, you see, go back to Healey's days, and when the carriers were written off. And the then First Sea Lord, David Luce, charming man and a very able one too, he resigned over it. I will come back to this point about resignations later on in a rather more personal and a rather more interesting way. At the time, various members of the Admiralty Board volunteered to go with him. And had they done so then, and I'm talking of 1960...
Five or six?
Yeah, something like that, mid-60s, you know. If the entire board had gone, and it could have been replaced, of course. Boards always can be replaced. There are plenty of good younger men coming up. They won't have had as much experience, but they will have had quite a lot, and so on. And if they'd all gone in the body then, this is pure speculation, it just might have tipped the scales. With a man like Healey, I don't think it would have done. I think Healey said, get stuffed. But for a single individual, the First Sea Lord of the day, and into the bargain, that First Sea Lord had been at great pains to tell the others that they were not to resign, they were not to follow his example. But he felt he had to for the sake of, for the honour of the Navy, really. And it was, frankly, as splendid man they may have been, it was a futile gesture, and it made no difference at all. In the case of when I was the Chief of Staff, when I was First Sea Lord, I don't think that whoever had resigned would have made any odds at all. It could have been the entire board, it could have been all the Chiefs of Staff, you name it. I don't think it would have affected the issue myself. I think the moment had passed.
Right.
Thank you for that. I'm ready for your next point.
Well, I turn now to another. You think that I'm constantly having John Knott. I can only say that after he took office, my having a go at the Defence Secretary was pretty constant. And that was the way life went. And whereas earlier I said I could have looked forward to 3 years of pretty well unadulterated bliss, it was a long, hard struggle, and it was very unpleasant, because one doesn't like going on like this. Amongst the cuts that were seriously contemplated was the disposal of the two assault ships, Fearless and Intrepid. As I think I'd said earlier, Knott had really never paid a visit to the fleet. And the opportunity arose for him to do so. And although it was a different ballpark of importance from the question of Invincible, to which I shall again return later on, the question of the assault ships was pretty important also. And so it just happened that Thurlis was, she wasn't working up, she was fully worked up, but she was doing a week's weapon training at Portland. And I managed to get the Secretary of State to agree that he would pay a short day's visit to Fearless at Portland. Easy to get to, fly in a helicopter from London or Norfolk down, and so on. And I got on to the captain of Fearless personally, which was unusual. And I said, you are to pull the stops out. And I told him, I can always remember the words, I said, I don't mind what you do, but you're to go to the limit and even somewhat beyond. I'd rather you didn't actually kill anybody, but if you do, I will stand ready to back you. Pull the stops out. And the day dawned, and unlike some days at Portland, it was gorgeous. It was sunny, clear sky, calm sea, no wind, and down went John Knott, and he had a splendid day, and the ship did well. They pulled all the stops out. I don't know everything they did, but they laid everything on, and they did it in a big, impressive way. And they had a number of tricks up their sleeve that they could play, which were impressive. And Knott came back to London, and next day I found a note on my desk, personally from him. Whose idea was it to dispose of these two fine ships? And I wrote the shortest letter of my life, formally, back, and I simply said, from, to, and all that stuff, yours. And that was the last I heard. And they were saved. But what a way to run the shop. And of course, being saved, they came off the list. So the cuts, their equivalent, had to be found from somewhere else. And that was typical. Through sheer lack of professional knowledge. But if you'd asked the chief scientific advisor, and he would have said, well, what useful part can they play in the Greenland, Iceland, Faroes gap? And the answer was zero. The next thing was the question of Trident. And I've covered the business of Polaris improvement, Chevalin, with its rival Poseidon in an earlier tape. But now the Americans had ceased production of Trident, so it was just as well that we had not got Poseidon. It was just as well that we had not gone for Poseidon, as events turned out. And it was really Trident or bust, Trident D5. And this, I'm glad to say, was decided, and it was to be announced to the House in a special announcement, one forenoon. And the fact of it was that apart from the warhead, much of whose cost lay with the central scientific staff, the considerable additional cost of Trident, instead of being parceled out between the three services in the centre, as had been Polaris and Polaris improvements, and as had been the bees in their time, was to be landed totally on the Navy. And I made a point of being in the House, in the gallery, when Knott made his announcement. And he did, and he said some very flat statement like the government had decided to go for the replacement independent strategic nuclear deterrent in the form of Trident D5. And such was the interest at the time that the Speaker ruled that although there was not going to be a debate on this subject, but they have a sort of variation on a theme whereby each party is allowed to ask a single question, and it's up to whoever was the deliverer of this news to answer the questions, and no debate would follow. That wasn't permitted. And I can't remember which side of the House it came from, but some guy got up and said, could the Right Honourable Gentleman assure the House that, contrary to current rumours, the full cost of Trident would not be borne by the Royal Navy? And John Knott said in reply, as the Honourable Gentleman would suppose, the full cost of Trident will be borne by defence. Now, that was a clever twist of words, but the term defence, used in that sort of context, meant the three services in the centre. Half an hour later, I found myself in the MOD conference room, where the Defence Secretary was going to hold a press conference on going for Trident. And the room was packed. And he came in last. I was sitting up on the platform, a couple away from him. And he came in, and as he passed my chair, he said, he always called me CNS as opposed to First Sea Lord, Chief Naval Officer. As he passed my chair, he turned to me and said, sorry about that, CNS, but you know how it is. And I was absolutely furious, of course. And I said, yes, Secretary of State, I know precisely how it is. And on we went for the press conference. This was a straight black lie to the House. Not a very clever thing to do. The next fairly major event was that Keith Speed, the Navy Minister, with whom I got on, dare I say it, very well, very easily, he'd had 11 years in the Navy himself, and was very sympathetic to the Navy. He had rather exaggerated ideas about sending wrens to sea, but never mind, I was able to play that one to touch. At the time, and he made a speech to his constituency down in Kent, near Ashford, or thereabouts, over, I think, a weekend. And in it, he really did no more than present, biased, if you like, towards the Navy, but he presented the naval case in this public speech. and all hell was let loose as soon as the following week came. And I remember I'd had occasion to be in Frank Cooper's office on some quite other matter at the time. And I remember Frank, who was a good man, and we were friends, and I remember him saying, oh, of course, Speed will have to go. And Speed was sacked. He was rung up. He was at a dinner party, I think. And he was rung up in the middle of dinner by, I suppose, probably John Knott. I don't know, who'd just come from the Prime Minister. But anyway, one way or another, he was told that he was off. And that was it. And so next day, when he left, I saw him off, as did most of the naval staff who gathered along the corridor to see him off. And he was very upset about this, very upset. And there it was. But as a result, for quite a number of months, several months, multiple months, the Navy did not have its own Navy Minister. The Army and the Air Force did. Not the be-all and end-all, but it was another line of approach, line of attack, line of defense, in circumstances of a formidable defense review. And we didn't have that man. Now, in due course, several months later, all the service ministers were phased out. So the Army Minister and the Air Force Minister left. And they were replaced by, instead of a single Minister of State, they were replaced by two Ministers of State. One, I'm talking generalities, one for people and the other for things. But of course, they each had to deal with those affairs of each of the three services. And therefore their opportunities of getting out into the field and meeting the people at the sharp end were that much rarer. Through no fault of theirs, it was just the organization. I have to say that departing Minister for the Air Force, one Geoffrey Patty, was a shining, I was about to say disciple, but it's the wrong way around, a shining lead for Michael Beeson, the Chief of the Air Staff, in being irrationally and to an extent irresponsibly biased in favor of anything to do with the Air Force, to get it come hell or high. And regarded the question of statesmanship, it simply didn't arise at all. To such an extent that I sent him a little, I concocted a little bit of doggerel. I sent it along and had it placed on his desk. I did not get a reply. And it just drew his attention to the fact that we were actually all part of a team, and a little bit of statesmanship now and then would not come amiss. I didn't expect a reply, and I didn't get it. But I was quite open about this, and I sent Terry Lewin a copy. I don't think he particularly wanted to know that he had received that copy. After the change, yes, I got this right, I think, the minister in charge of people was a man called Jerry Wiggin, who's alive and kicking. He's now Sir Jerry Wiggin. Don't ask me to detail precisely why, but anyway, he is. Long service and extraordinarily indifferent performance. There it is. And He's a great big man, and he's... I've met a number of politicians over the years, and some have been intelligent, and some have been thick, and some have been very thick, and he was in the latter category. To such an extent that after the odd, utterly fatuous, non-result meeting that I'd really had to go to, chaired by him, I quite wrongly turned to one of my staff as we were storming back to our rooms, and I grabbed two planks, and somehow it got out, and it went the rounds of the MOD, and Jerry Wiggin became known as Two Planks, and I have to regret, but I don't regret at all, it was a statement of fact, that I was the responsible perpetrator for that.
Did you suspect at all that he'd been, that when someone of clearly palpable lack of competence is put in place at minister of state level, did it ever cross your mind that he was there to enable other people, John Knott and his acolytes, perhaps to get on with what they really wanted to get on with, and leave him just in the front shop?
Yes, I think so. I mean, he was he was really so useless that he might just well not have been there. He was a positive, he was a menace, as far as I was concerned. And, for example, I remember going to a meeting in his office, and as usual, he wasn't ready. He called the meeting, and he wasn't ready for us. So we hung around in his outer office, and his secretary, a civil servant, was there sitting at his desk. And over the years, I have acquired a certain aptitude. I couldn't do it now because my eyesight's not good enough, but a certain aptitude for reading upside down the contents of other people's in baskets or whatever. And in one of these, one of the secretary's trays, there was a whole pile of foolscap-sized stuff. And I glanced at it, glanced down it, and the word Navy occurred here and the word Navy occurred there, and I didn't read very much more. But the opening phrase was, what on earth is all this about, et cetera, et cetera. Well, that meant the door opened and we went in for the meeting, which as usual was a total no-decision bout. And when we came out, I picked up one of these slips and the secretary made to stop me. And I said, oh, I see this is about the Navy, so I'm the First Sea Lord. I'm quite interested in a thing called the Navy. And I walked out of the office and got back to my own and read this thing in some detail. I still got it in my scrapbook. And it was a most disgraceful thing. And it turned, half a dozen, I won't go into detail, but it turned half a dozen things absolutely upside down. And so I put the naval staff onto, as a matter of some urgency, refuting these things, taking them apart one by one, which was dead easy for them to do. And speaking the truth. And it started, actually the truth is. And I had these circulated. I never heard any more about it. I never heard anything out of Wiggin himself. And I don't know what the outcome was. Didn't actually get us anywhere. Now you may say that was all very petty and very cheap and nasty. But it irritated me beyond words. It was rather sort of the straw to break the camel's back, that someone in his position of authority was stooping so low as to formally issue what amounted to a tissue of lies, and I wasn't for having it.
And you, by happy chance, happened to discover it?
I happened to discover it. And this was by way of being a brief for I think largely for other members of Parliament.
Oh, I see.
Who might, and would, of course, have had contact with the media. I forgot to say, before Francis Pym was moved sideways, that he got a bit twitchy about publicity. And the form it took with him, and it's amazing how history repeats itself, but the form it took with him was that nobody in any of the service departments was to have direct access to the media without specific approval from his office. That's how it ran. In the circumstances of the time, I virtually totally ignored this. And I've got pages extracted from cuttings of newspapers of the day in which I exposed, never the whole, I don't think, but substantial chunks of the truth and reality, risking my neck in doing so.
So you briefed newspapers on the record?
Yes, I did.
Contrary to the Secretary of State's...
Yes, but it was a different Secretary of State, was my excuse. Pretty feeble excuse.